This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. As the Cincinnati area joins the rest of the world in combating the spread of COVID-19, the novel coronavirus, we're reminded that this is not the region's first brush with a global pandemic. The 1918 Spanish flu pandemic hit Cincinnati pretty hard as well, but the Queen City dealt with more than that over the years. In fact, local historian and writer Greg Hand said, quote, "Epidemics used to be the norm: smallpox, yellow fever, malaria, and especially cholera. Cholera was more deadly than COVID-19 or the flu, with a 10 to 12% fatality rate. An 1849 outbreak led to the creation of more orphanages in Cincinnati." So let's talk to Greg Hand. Joining Cincinnati Edition now as local historian and writer of the website Cincinnati Curiosities, Greg Hand. Greg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. I'm such a fan of Cincinnati Curiosities. It's, I guess your tagline is working overtime to keep alive the weird soul of the Queen City. You have a lot of interesting nuggets of local history and lore explored on this site. You do such a great job of keeping it updated, and you're always fascinating to talk to, but you also have some really strong knowledge about those events. And I reached out to you to get some perspective on what has happened in history in Cincinnati. And the idea was based on an article that you had written just a couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago. It was published in Cincinnati Magazine about the 1918 Spanish flu and its impact here in Cincinnati. You responded with all of these other ideas of experiences we've had. So give us a little bit of background on just how common these pandemics used to be, like you said.
You know, for a large part of Cincinnati's history, people didn't even know what a bacteria was. And so human beings everywhere were just sitting ducks for anything that came through. And in the Cincinnati area, everything came through: smallpox, cholera, malaria, typhus. We actually had cases of bubonic plague here. And so to put these in perspective, you know, since we didn't know what bacteria was, we didn't know what antibiotics were, for example. And so the estimates right now with the novel coronavirus, the COVID-19, is that it's got a fatality rate of something like 3%, 2 or 3% of the people who contract the disease, whereas cholera, when it hit Cincinnati, killed as many as 12% of the people who got the disease. This was at a time when the entire population of Cincinnati was about 115,000, and we lost 8,000 people in a year. That's like 7% of the entire population dying in 1 year. So this was very serious stuff.
Your story about the 1918 Spanish flu, and we're going to touch on some of these other pandemics that swept through, but your story about it, one of the most fascinating aspects was the inclusion of some photographs that originated from Cincinnati and are in the National Archives. And one has a photo of a barber, and I think you can see this now on our website at wvxu.org. He's, you know, he's got his tools out, and there's a man lying back, I think, awaiting a shave, and he's wearing a mask. And there's a photo of some World War I era soldiers who were on the streets in Cincinnati. They're also wearing masks. There's a sign in a window, a photo also from the National Archives, that is hanging in a window in Cincinnati that says, "Keep your bedroom windows open, prevent influenza, pneumonia, tuberculosis." So there seems to be some similarities in the way that we still respond when these types of diseases start to spread. Cover your face, maybe keep some distance, do some things at home. Maybe keeping your window open may not be exactly scientifically correct, but some things haven't changed over the century.
The photos that you just described really indicate some significant societal changes that have happened in the last 100 years. For instance, that barber, you know, during the current shelter-in-place regulations, things like hair salons and barbers and that are on the list of places that should be shut. That could not happen in 1918 because people did not have razors at home. The only place you could get a shave was to go out. Similarly, saloons were allowed to stay open in 1918 because it was impossible legally to separate saloons from restaurants. And so few people had the ability to cook and eat food at home that they had to leave these places open or people would starve to death. People didn't live in apartments that had kitchens. They lived in sleeping rooms and took their meals out. And so there are these incredible changes. But at the same time, as you have pointed out, many of the mechanisms that were called upon are very similar. Cover your face, cover your cough, wash your hands, stay away from people, that sort of thing.
A September 1918 Cincinnati Post used the headline, "Spanish Grip is with us." And per your article, the quote pulled from that article says, quote, "Spanish influenza, a germ disease which started a worldwide journey in Spain, has arrived in Cincinnati. It was announced by Dr. William H. Peters, acting health officer, Wednesday." The article went on to say, "Those catching it may derive consolation from the fact that the Germans have had it too. The disease, which is more uncomfortable than serious, has affected several Cincinnatians, according to unofficial reports made to Dr. Peters by physicians." So, Greg, this is an early report about the spread of this disease that includes a little bit of misinformation. One, we know now, of course, that the Spanish flu did not start in Spain. It was a nickname that was given to it. And also, this turned out to be quite a serious affair. Are there some similarities with the early reporting that we saw on COVID-19 as it started to spread around the globe?
Oh, absolutely. There are absolutely parallels because not only was there a great deal of misinformation, for instance, you mentioned photographs of those soldiers wearing masks. It is highly likely that they were carrying influenza. This disease was spread in the army camps. It was spread in the army training camps. It was spread from soldiers returning after World War I. The soldiers were the vectors, and you're correct that even though it was first reported from Spain or first discussed in Spain, it's probable that this disease arose on the pig farms of Kansas, and supplies being sent to soldiers overseas. So there was a great deal of misinformation. However, you mentioned Dr. Peters here in Cincinnati. This guy was one of the people who jumped on the information as it was coming in and started announcing that Cincinnati was going to be doing what we would now call social distancing very early on. He was one of the medical experts who just took this misinformation, drilled down to find the reality, and acted on it very quickly.
So that article from the Cincinnati Post that I just referenced, that was published on September 18, 1918. Just a few weeks later, on October 6, 1918, the Inquirer published the orders from the Board of Health, just as you were starting to reference there. It said, quote, "Drastic measures were taken yesterday by the Cincinnati Board of Health to check the spread of influenza in Cincinnati and vicinity. By unanimous vote, the members adopted a resolution ordering the closing of all churches, schools, theaters, including motion picture theaters, and public meeting places until the danger of an epidemic of the disease has passed." I mean, that's so chilling because, and it goes on to note, of course, in your article, your words, Norwood, Covington, Newport, other nearby cities also issued similar or identical orders. It was a ban on public congregation that lasted 38 days. And like you noted, spared saloons. So we're not quite at 38 days of our social distancing yet, but it is just so chilling to see the similarities from that period to what we're going through today, don't you think?
Absolutely. The other thing that comes through in the correspondence, the letters to the editor, that sort of thing, there's a great deal of fear, and you can tell this fear and anxiety coming through. And people kept writing to the papers about misinformation. There was a lot of, for instance, racially tinged anxieties. You know, Cincinnati at that time had perhaps one third of the population who was either foreign born or lived in households with foreign born. And people were saying, should I talk to these Syrians, these Italians? You know, aren't they the ones who are the cause of this disease? And so when we hear about people, for instance, avoiding Chinese restaurants during the COVID-19 situation, very similar things were going on in 1918.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined on the phone by Greg Hand. He's a local historian and maintains this really terrific website full of historic information and anecdotes and interesting tales called Cincinnati Curiosities. Google it. You'll find it. It's a must read. Make it part of your daily reading. He does update it just about every day, and I'm a big fan of it. You're also very knowledgeable about the University of Cincinnati, and a lot of us in the media knew you well because you spent many, many years as the public information officer there. And I bring that up
yes.
because UC's campus had a significant role in this Spanish flu pandemic in 1918. Can you tell us a little bit about what was going on that campus there?
The University of Cincinnati was basically turned into an army training camp. And a lot of army engineers and a lot of things that involved higher mathematics, artillery, that sort of thing. The training was going on at the University of Cincinnati. And basically, once word got around that soldiers in the military were spreading the influenza in 1918, the University of Cincinnati was shut down. Basically, the entire campus was put under quarantine, and it was several months before activities returned to normal. The University of Cincinnati football team that year only played a five-game season. It was only the very end of the season that was able to be played after the peak of infection passed.
And then there was Camp Sherman outside Chillicothe, and there were nearly 1,200 people dead there.
Camp Sherman was a plague spot. It was a transit point for soldiers leaving the area to go to Europe and coming back. And so there was this crossbreeding going on. As soldiers would come back, they would bring the disease with them. They would pass it to soldiers who were heading out. They would take the disease outward and infect soldiers who were coming back. Most of the Army transit centers, there was one in Georgia, I forget the name of it, had very, very high death rates in 1918.
I want to read about the impact that the 1918 flu pandemic had on the Cincinnati Fire Department. This is a quote from a November 5, 1918 article from the Cincinnati Inquirer that was included in an article about that period by Greg Hand, with whom we speak today. Quote, "Influenza has played havoc with the fire department, according to Fire Chief Barney Houston. 8 members of the department have died of influenza, and 139 have been stricken with the disease, according to his record." The article goes on to say, he said more than 100 firemen were off duty yesterday because of illness, necessitating the temporary abandonment of 2 companies, Fire Company No. 44 and Water Tower No. 2, 7th and Sycamore Streets. And what's sad about that, Greg, is that these were firefighters who were kept in close quarters, of course, easily spreading it between themselves. And then, of course, they would go home and spread it to their families.
Exactly. They didn't use the term first responders 100 years ago, but that was the situation that you were seeing. Firemen, much more than police, because the firemen were confined within the firehouses, whereas the police were sent out from police stations. But fire and police were both hit very heavily. They are the sorts of public employees who have to interact with the public. When somebody is reported as being ill, they're the ones on the scene, and they were hit very, very heavily. It took years, actually, for staffing to recover in the fire department.
Here's something that's possibly relevant to our situation now as we reflect today on the 1918 flu situation in the Cincinnati area, because there is talk about when does our social distancing period end? When does some of this quarantining end? And you wrote, Greg, that when the ban on gatherings was partially lifted and children returned to school, another wave of illness and death washed over the cities. You wrote businesses protested restrictions such as ordering all retail establishments to close by 4:30. Shopkeepers noted that restricted sales hours led to greater congestion on the streetcars, negating any sanitary impact. And at one point, the health department considered a citywide quarantine, closing every factory, office, and store in town, but relented under intense public pressure. Again, Greg, something that could be similar to the conversation we're having now.
You could pull that article out of the 1918 newspaper and print it today, and you would think that it was happening all over again. As they say, deja vu all over again. You can see that the economic forces were saying we've got to get back to normal. And what was happening is that the disease was setting its own schedule. Children were getting sick at school. They were being reinfected. They were taking that disease home. And you can look at the mortality schedules and just see this second peak pop up and take another hundreds of deaths.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. I'm joined on the phone by Greg Hand. He's a local historian and writer of the website Cincinnati Curiosities, something that you should check out. We're talking about the way previous epidemics and pandemics had impacted Cincinnati. And so we spent a lot of time, Greg, just now talking about the 1918 flu that we experienced in the Cincinnati area and the terrible toll it took on our people. But like you had mentioned at the top of this, it wasn't the only type of illness that came through. And we were quarantined in Cincinnati back in 1878. This was about yellow fever?
Yes. Yes, there was a the health administrator in Cincinnati. I should mention that the health administrator in Cincinnati was named health administrator against his will. He was so highly respected that he was voted into office without his approval, but just as a good citizen, he served two terms and then went back to private practice. But he was brought in just as one of these perfect storm years originated in Memphis. There was heavy rains in Memphis. An enormous number of mosquitoes were breeding, and yellow fever was being spread by these mosquitoes onto boats that were shipping into Cincinnati. Cincinnati was a major river port in 1878, and all these infected steamboats were coming up the Mississippi to the Ohio River to Cincinnati. And so Dr. Minor, that was his name, with absolutely no legal authority, decided to quarantine Cincinnati. He set up inspectors in Walton, Kentucky, and in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, to stop any train on any railroad that was heading towards Cincinnati. And he set up a barricade on the Ohio River in the Delhi Township riverbank and stopped any steamboat. His inspectors would then inspect the trains, inspect the steamboats, and if they were okay, they could move on. If they weren't, they stayed there until the disease took its course, which meant any of the infected passengers either survived or died.
I know that today we know so much more about science, although we can still certainly deal with the fact that we're humans and can become sick, but what type of methods were health professionals like the health administrator in 1878 using to base their decisions on how to get a handle on these things?
You know, by 1878, the medical community was finally coming to an agreement that there was a particular type of medicine that worked. In Cincinnati, for instance, around 1860, there were 9 medical colleges. There were not 9 medical colleges because it was a boom in medicine and lots of people wanted to become doctors. There were 9 medical colleges because nobody could agree on what medicine was. Physicians did not talk to surgeons, was one of the major disputes. But we had allopathic physicians, we had homeopathic physicians, we had eclectic physicians, we had botano-medical doctors. There were all these schools of medicine that that were fighting with each other and announcing that all of the other practitioners were frauds, that it was almost like a religion. If you come to the allopaths, we'll cure you, and those botano-medical people are just fakes. And so by 1878, we're finally coming to a general agreement about what is going to cure you, but we still had things like bleeding. We had medicines that contained poisonous mercury compounds. We had medicines that were basically opium and chloroform mixed in with flavoring like sassafras. The disease, in many cases, was much worse or much better than the cure in some cases.
And again, we're talking with Greg Hand. And before I let you go, Greg, I could talk to you all day, of course, but I want to talk about polio. I mean, this was something that impacted the entire world, and it attacked Cincinnati right up until the vaccine.
You know, I was struck by how recent polio was. When I was a child, at my grandmother's house, I discovered that on her bookshelves were 2 library books that were overdue for many, many years. And she had to tell me, no, during the 1940s, during a polio epidemic, we were told if you have library books out, don't bother bringing them back because we're afraid they're going to spread polio around.
And that's the same order we're getting now about COVID-19 from libraries. Like, go ahead, hang on to your things, return them at a later date.
Right. And so in 1948, 1949, 1944, there were epidemics of polio in the Cincinnati area that were severe enough. They were closing swimming pools. There was a belief that the disease spread through through water, all sorts of quarantine restrictions. The thing is that with polio, once you got it, only about 50 to 60% of the people who got it recovered completely. The rest incurred some form of paralysis that lasted their entire lives. And for 5 to 10%, the rest of their lives was very short because it turned out to be a fatal disease.
Greg Hand is a local historian and the author of the website Cincinnati Curiosities. Google that or go to WVXU.org and click on the Cincinnati Edition tab where this story is posted. You'll find a link. I highly recommend that you read it. Greg, this was fascinating stuff. I'm so appreciative of your time and the perspective on Cincinnati's historic dealings with health epidemics and pandemics. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to join you, Michael. Take care.
We'll talk again soon. And we want to hear from you as well. So if you have the WVXU app, I hope you'll click on the Talk to Us tab. We're collecting voice messages about how you're dealing with COVID-19 and the shutdowns of certain businesses and maybe some self-quarantining or some severe social distancing. We want to hear from you. That's on our app. If you don't have the app, download the app and then click on the Talk to Us tab and we'll hear from you that way. Or you can give us a call the old-fashioned way at 513-419-7100. Even when we're not broadcasting, you can leave a voicemail for us and we'll be putting some of those in our upcoming shows just to hear from you, how you're doing right now. And up next on Cincinnati Edition, the local distillery that's joining others across the region and the country in turning its attention to the manufacturing of hand sanitizer. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Marks.